Okay, oh good. I was logged on through my own account and I couldn't turn on the recording, so. Are you today, John?
Very good. And how are you?
I'm good too. I'm very pleased. I got a big piece of like a big job that I had in front of me done yesterday, so I'm feeling a bit lighter today.
Yes, that feels much better. Heather, we can't see Heather.
No,
So
I
is
think
it...
she logged on and then because it wasn't active, she's probably
Oh.
to come back in a moment, imagine.
Hello.
Hi, Doug.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hey, good to see you again, Jocelyn.
Yes, thank you. Nice to see you too. Yeah, I apologize. I was not there last time. I'm sorry about that.
It turned out okay.
We had a good session last time, I think. So you
prepared, John?
Yes, you assigned me to six, right? Chapter six.
Cora needs to come on and do five, so.
Great. I wanted to facilitate an exercise, about
Sure.
15 minutes for the group
Yeah, I
to lead
assume
off on that one.
you might have an exercise.
Yes, right. I'm a very experiential kind of
You're like
guy.
Heather, you want, so the two of you are good for experiment.
Yeah, it's sort of like someone said you can't learn how to swim by reading a manual. You have to sort of get into the water.
You have to get thrown in, right?
Exactly.
Hello, Heather.
Hey, good morning.
Good.
Or afternoon.
Yeah, it's still morning.
Okay.
Marco. No sign of Cora yet. Oh, she wanted me to post something too. We need Cora to start, really, so.
Hello, Marco.
Hello.
No hail or mega storms today.
No, it's a beautiful day. That's why I'm sitting outside. I may go back in front of my computer if this gets distracting, or I may not. Maybe the distraction will be part of the agencement of the event.
There you go.
Is that a French word, adjustment, or is it
Agencement, yeah.
pronounced by agents?
Yeah, it's Deleuze's word from the original text that he wrote, and Brian Massumi translated it into English as assemblage. But the assemblage, as Erin points out, assemblage sounds like a collection, but agencement means an active direction movement. So assemblage is kind of the wrong, it's not the best translation of the term agencement.
That's interesting because I think she says later that there's a sister relationship between adjacement and minor gesture, or that there are sister concepts. So I was very interested in that in between.
Yeah, that's right. She does say that they're kind of cousins or something.
Yeah.
Has anyone proposed a better translation of that word?
I think adjacency is for me, it's a cousin, conceptual cousin.
But adjacency
It's
doesn't
what's next to something, you know?
adjacency doesn't have the dynamics of agencement.
It does the way I use it. Yeah, in geometry, I think there's like a two, if you share two sides or something like that, it's adjacency. Yeah. But it's also like if you're next door neighbor or you share a fence with a shared territory, I think those are all complementary. But I'm very interested in facilitation for sociality of two, or three or four or five or however many are together. It's so what's often I think what creates shifts is what's next to someone, rather than what's on the other side of the world. It could be something very close by that could be. You could enter into a facilitating a rapprochement with that, what's next to you. And that's, I think, very challenging to think about, especially if you're into grand gestures, as I tend to be, which tend to evade those adjacencies that are nearby.
Hmm.
Anyway, I'm just riffing.
Well, it's interesting, though, because you're using the word adjacency in a way that gives it agency. And I think, you know, typically or maybe neurotypically, we might just think of adjacency as being sort of in a fixed position next to something else. If something is adjacent, it's, you know, it's there, but it's not in your location, it's nearby. And you're highlighting the active aspect or the contributing aspect of what is adjacent.
Right, it's like riding a bicycle and you're going to get on the other side of town. You live in Manhattan. That's your goal, your outcome, right? But you'd better be very aware of what's adjacent to you if you're going to make it. So it's really about negotiating the shifting adjacencies. And there are going to be cars that go in front of you, pedestrians that cut in front of you, red lights, green lights, yellow lights that sometimes don't work. So we have all these signs that we're supposed, and these are sort of the rules that we all know and agree to obey, but nobody does obey them. They break them all the time, including me. So it's very spontaneous sometimes, and it could lead to sometimes occasional disaster. But somehow in my life. Sorry.
That's all right. I was just looking for the right spot. Cardinal Newman talks about juxtaposition in a way I think maybe similar to what you're describing with adjacency. So in his piece on liberal education, he says that two courses taken at the same time contribute to the liberally educated individual, much like two colors next to one another on a palette for the artist. So each one shades the other one slightly differently. You experience them differently in juxtaposition.
Yeah, I love that word, juxtaposition.
Also for adjacency, I'll get to Cora in a moment, but
hello.
One of my colleagues, a man by the name of Chris Gold, worked for many years on a data structure, so it's a computer data structure, but it's built on the Voronoi diagram, and the Voronoi diagram is a mathematical way of representing adjacency that's very interesting. And he developed a dynamic spatiotemporal data structure using this. So it's the same kind of thing where you're talking about when you're moving through New York and you have all these different adjacencies, only it's actually implemented on a computer and does that. So I think I can probably find a video clip of what it looks like, and I'll post it on the site. I think you'll enjoy that.
Please do.
Cora, you're up for chapter 5.
I am. Pretty excited about that chapter, I have to say. Yes, you were right, Jeffrey. Probably an appropriate one to delve into in terms of my own thinking. And should we move ahead with that?
Yeah.
First of all, nice to see everyone. It seems like 2 weeks is a big chunk of time in connecting and then reconnecting. So it feels like so much happens in that period of time. So it's really a pleasure to reconvene with everyone consistently like this. So chapter five is like, wow, I could probably sit. At first I thought, well, every paragraph could maybe constitute a full discussion for me, 2 hour discussion. And then I said, no, no, wait, it's not even a paragraph. It's probably a sentence that could constitute a full discussion. So I thought, well, how do I want to approach this today? And what would be best for us as a group? As I was reading through the chapter, I thought, well, I could quite selfishly guide this conversation towards some of the things that I've been thinking about and, you know, draw our attention in a particular way. But I think what would be best is to do what she's asking us to do, which is essentially opening up and allowing the conversation and our time together to move in a direction that we can't really predict. And in essence, we do that anyways. I mean, without thinking about it, we conversations go in particular directions without knowing where they're going to end up. But maybe what I'm doing today is just drawing our attention to that, that in essence, it's a kind of method. And I keep saying every week, well, I'm so attached and so committed to the kinds of things that Aaron is talking about. But I keep asking that question, like, so how do you do this? Like, you know, and this goes to my research as well too, methodologically. Like, what are the tools? What are the techniques? And in fact, the technique is this. This is the technique, is creating certain openings and creating the conditions for something else to happen that we can't. So that's my intention. What I'll do is I'll just go through the chapter. There's a couple of sort of major points or junctures that I will speak to. I will bring in how I am related or attached to those particular ideas. But then if I can, I'll try and pose a larger question for everyone to see where you might take that yourself. So some of this may ring or be resonant to you with these particular ideas, and others may not. And I remember with Deleuze, actually, I think it was, yes, it was Deleuze that said it, but it was Misumi that brought out point in his foreword to A Thousand Plateaus, which was, we can take these ideas and concepts as a kind of toolbox. Some of those tools are more appropriate or useful or relevant to each of us. So I'll try and do that as I go through the chapter, and you can choose as you go along as to what is most relevant to you. I was thrilled to begin with, and what she really is attending to is Spinoza's original question of what can a body do, and that runs as a beautiful theme throughout the chapter. I've grappled with this question as well too over the last 10 years or so with my dear colleague Jeffrey and Pat and other people that I've had the great fortune of encountering during my academic career. And what we did was that we really did move from a kind of medical understanding of the body, of what a body is, to what a body can do using these philosophical ideas originating from Spinoza. But what I was really excited about in this chapter is that she says, well, let's take it one step further. What else can a body do? And I think that really gets to the heart of what she's talking about. And in terms of the her grappling with people with autism, and I think we have been trying to do the same thing with children with physical disabilities. There's just to capture what I was talking about earlier in trying not to direct this conversation so much in a particular way. On page 117, it's a beautiful question she asks. She says, what occurs to activate the pulling of a movement? And I'll change the word movement to conversation. What occurs to activate the pulling of this conversation in a new direction if human intentionality or agency is not the core activator? I think that's really beautiful. And also right at the end, which I think addresses us as a group, and this gets back to Deleuze and Guattari as well, it's worth repeating that a group subject, as Guattari defines, it is not simply a group of individuals. The group subject is defined by the group as it's formed in the encounter, not organized around the self-presentation of its members, but directed by the ways the group attunes to the necessity of its coming into formation. The group is never the sum of its parts, but rather an emergent collectivity, which for Guattari always co-composes across the overlapping fields of the environment, the social, and the psychic. So again, just to reiterate my intention for this short introduction. And again, going back to the theoretical ideas that run through this, I'm excited about the notion of what else a body can do. And I think what's also very interesting is the drawing in of what else a body can do within a particular environment. And in our research, we used James Gibson as well to look at the environment in a particular way in which the environment invites us to move in particular ways. I think it's fascinating that she is looking at this now in relationship to the autistic perception of environment and the body within that. What else can a body do? What does the body already know that may not be to most neurotypical understanding of what a body can do in relationship to the environment? So that's beautifully thread through all of this as well too. I think it's very interesting how I think as we tend to be neurotypical when we enter an environment, that we go through this process of chunking, that we're looking at the environment in terms of objects, and not a kind of edging into form, a tending of light and shadow and color, where a person with autism perhaps would experience a room in that way. So that gets back to some of the research we've been doing with the children. They describe their environments in this way. They move about their environments in a way that we ourselves have probably lost in terms of how we encounter our environments. There is an important time lapse between the direct perception of the emergent ecology and the actual taking form of the objects and subjects in its midst. The notion of this time lapse is very interesting to me. And I wonder for you what that means for you in the kinds of questions that you're asking, the work you're doing. What is this time lapse in between the interval, as she might describe it? And I know Jeffrey, and I'll ask you this question later if we get back to it, but how does that relate to prehension as far as Whitehead is concerned? What is the relationship between this time interval of experiencing an environment? Other thoughts that jumped out at me are a self-sufficient body is regarded as a body that can consciously make decisions based on a strong sense of where the body ends and where the world begins. I wonder about that in terms of where the body begins where the body ends and where the world begins. The children in our study as well, found it was impossible really for them to distinguish that. It's impossible for us to distinguish that. There's a little guy in a wheelchair that literally the wheelchair was of his body. And he moved in that way when we watched him. So that question is extremely important. And I ask you as well too, in your own lives, do you encounter that perception or that fleeting moment of where you're not sure where your body begins, ends, and where the environment begins? There's an amazing educator named Ken Robinson, a British thinker and scholar, who suggests that children are all children, and we're not talking about children with particular impairments of, and I don't even want to use that word, differences autistically or in the way that they move. And he says that all children are geniuses. And somewhere along the way, through our education, our socialization, we become less genius. We don't see and feel the environment in the way that children do, automatically do. They can't explain it. I asked direct questions to young 3- and 4-year-olds. What does it feel like when your body moves like that? And they looked at me as if I had 3 heads, because you don't really articulate an experience like that as a child, as to what is your body, what does it feel like, where does it begin, where does the environment begin? They just are. They're just moving within that environment. So I ask you that question as well, too. Like, where at this point in our lives, when did we stop this genius understanding of body and environment as children? How did that become unlearned? That's not even the right word. How did that become not part of how we experience these environments? Why are we looking for subjects and objects and clear volition and intention within particular environments? Why aren't we looking at environments in ways that they are, in fact, inviting ways of moving, ways of thinking, ways of being with one another that cannot be really described? If you have an answer to that, when did that happen to us, where we stopped becoming geniuses as children in this relationship that Aaron is talking about? The notion of the body envelope, I think, is fascinating. It's a beautiful description. When I, in a very sort of off sort of track way, I thought, have you ever had an envelope where you've decided whether you were going to seal it or whether you were just going to tuck in the edge of the envelope? And then why did you decide to do one or the other? Why was it important to seal an envelope, and why is it sometimes important just to tuck it in so it's easier to open? I think that's really interesting in terms of a body envelope as well, too. It's like, what are the cracks and the openings? What is that space in between that allows a body to be something else? I think that's a fascinating concept. Just to continue with this notion of beginnings and endings, I have children, and I can relate completely to when she discusses on page 114 a child's difficulty in assigning hurt when they fall and their tendency to point to the ground instead of their knee. That's fascinating. When did we stop doing this? And how do we recapture this? And my big question I have is, if we recapture this, does that mean we're losing, we're calling it something, we're understanding it, we're moving it into a realm of consciousness? Do we lose the power of that by doing so? On page 115, from body to bodying, I think there's a big question here in terms of what are we doing in terms of physiotherapy and rehabilitation? It's a huge question, because if we're going to consider other ways of bodies and environments encountering one another, and for what a body can do, what else can a body do? Why, from a physio, for a rehabilitation point of view, are we trying to bring children's movement back into the neurotypical? What else is offered, really, by allowing the bodies to remain neurodiverse? And that's going to challenge an entire way of managing rehabilitation. Why are we asking children to move like their able-bodied counterparts? It's a scary question. It makes me very nervous, but she's put it out there, and I'm thinking about it as well, too. I love her notion of the movement of thought as elastic. I wonder then as well, too, that a body that has no movement at all, what kind of movement is happening within that body if we can't see it? And she describes that through the autistic example that she's given, that sort of tug of war inside him. Why is movement attached to intelligence? That in order to, for us to see movement, then that's going to deem a person intelligent. I'll bring foresight into here. Jeffrey, I'm not sure, were we able to bring up the synchronous objects onto the posting? I had a little trouble doing that, and I will try, if you were unable to do
it. I will post it, but I just haven't got to it yet. Okay. Yeah.
William Foresight is this renowned choreographer, worked primarily with Frankfurt Ballet, but a philosopher in his own right, where he said that the best kind of experience as a dancer, and I would agree, is this moments, and very fleeting moments as a performer, as a dancer, where you feel like your body is dancing you around. And I have only had fleeting moments of that as a performer. But when it happens, it is this most ecstatic experience where it's almost like you're looking upon yourself moving as opposed to directing your body in a particular way, but actually witnessing or sensing or feeling in a different way that in fact it's your body that's dancing you around. It's a fascinating concept. And I think for children as well too, although they wouldn't articulate it that way, I think their bodies dance them around more than they direct their bodies. And what can we learn from that? The posting that we'll put up is Forsythe's work, where he opened up or revealed the mechanisms of his choreography, of how people cue one another within a particular piece of choreography. The notion of cueing comes out through Aaron's writing in this chapter as well too, where I hadn't thought about it that way in particular, but the notion of cueing, how do we cue each other to move in particular ways? So what he's done is he took that information, he showed the cueing, and then he asked other people to rethink that. How else can data be represented through the notion of cueing? And maybe I fell into the conversation you were having about the subway. A beautiful example of how we're not making conscious decisions in movement. We are being we are remaining attuned and cued to these movements, these rhythms, these changes. And in the end, we end up with this beautiful piece of choreography and we have no idea how that occurred. I will look differently. Just like much of Deleuze's theory and also Gibson's theory as well too, I feel like I walk out the door and I see the world differently. The next time I get onto a subway platform, that's all I'm going to, I want to close my eyes and only feel the cueing of how we create this dance together and how we actually arrive somewhere and we don't know how we arrive there. I think that's also a tool for me to think about how I go into a classroom or watch children move. We've begun that, but it's this cueing and this beauty of watching children navigate that, encounter each other, create an event that happens and then simply falls away. I'm almost done. And then we can I will let you take it there to all of the directions that you'd like to take it. I love that she says, what is felt in the uneasy twitching of movement conditions? Beautiful. What does a movement class look like, or a movement event, where we don't begin with structure, but rather the cueing of individuals? I think at the end I was becoming quite overwhelmed at that point because I had so many ideas, but those are the ones that jumped out at me the most. I'll probably end with this. What new modes of existence call forth an articulation of the political that is not reducible to pre-existing constituencies, and thus is opening to creating and celebrating modes of life as yet uncharted? That is, if there's anything that I can attune myself or cue myself to in this work for the next 30 years in my own life, simply living, I hope I would be able to follow that kind of intention. I think I'll stop there, and that's perfect timing. My son just came in. He's just finished high school and wrote his last exam. So we're now in uncharted territory here once again in terms of what these new encounters are going to be for him as well too. That couldn't be better timing. Correct? Yeah. I'll leave it there. Those are my thoughts, and I hope I've opened, created some cracks and some openings for conversation. In no way am I intending on directing this conversation. I leave it to you to continue.
Thank you, Cora. I thought it was because I went back and looked at the heading of the chapter, and it's choreographing the political. So I do think it would be interesting to focus a little bit on, you know, because the choreographing is clear, but the political is there, but it needs to be teased out a bit more, maybe. The other thing I wanted to say the other thing I wanted to say is Marco has been doing a wonderful job of helping us not chunk.
Oh, good. Yes, very good. We don't want to chunk.
If you're looking at the gallery view, I've been looking at for the last, it's like, oh, I don't have to chunk this. I can just take it in.
Where are you?
I am in the state of Colorado, but in my backyard, just sort of wandering around within Wi-Fi range.
Movement, thought, and environment. I love it.
I thought it might go. It might carry the feeling.
It did. It did. I was so busy looking down at my notes and my the book that I missed that experience, but I'll watch you now.
I was jealous, you know. I wanted
We're all sitting in chairs again.
There
aren't
you
we?
Are, Marco. But
well, I read much of this chapter standing up, and I didn't plan to do that. But I remembered something that Doug had said about how, you know, he moves around when he reads, and I typically sit still when I read, and I try to get as still as possible. And the combination, I think, of that memory that I had of something that Doug had said in a previous conversation, and then the writing, the content of the chapter, moved me to get up and just start walking around in my studio. And it was a very, and also speaking aloud. So I was speaking the text to myself and hearing it at the same time that I was thinking it as I was moving. And I recalled as well that like some psychological kind of tests or, you know, show that you learn better when you're moving or when you're trying to do something that's physically difficult or awkward, like juggling, for example. If you're trying to juggle or, you know, stand on one leg, do something that is, you know, would challenge your, say, neurotypical way of relating to the problem or to what you're trying to learn, that you tend to retain it better. That just, you know, I wasn't doing it for that reason. It was just in the milieu of, And then I've been inside all morning reading, so I really just want to be outside.
That's our overarching argument, that children learn better when they're moving. So the ultimate goal of the research that we're working on now is to recreate environments that allow for this unknown encounters, so that children in a classroom, for instance, can be moving in particular ways because we do know that they're learning in more optimal ways.
I can't believe I grew up sitting in a classroom for, you know, 6-8 hours a day or however it was, like at a desk in those, you know, that grid, occasionally in a circle, you know, when there was some kind of a special lesson. But it was that, you know, 5 days a week from the time I was 4 or 5 to the time I was 18. And it has taken a lot to unlearn that. I'm unlearning it even right now as, you know, I read and as we speak. It's profound, I think.
I've taken to listening to audiobooks as I walk, you know, because that's another way of, because it's hard to, I used to do this when I was a young man. I used to walk down the street holding a book and reading it, but I tended to run into objects. And everybody used to laugh at me. So these days with audiobooks, you could do it without running into things. And you still pay attention to the environment, which is,
of course,
which is what's nice about it. So go ahead, Jocelyn. Unmute yourself. And
yes, thank you very much, Cora, for your presentation. It's very touchy and very grounded to to emotion, and at the same time the concepts are there and very well illustrated. What I would like to say is about the politics. You know, autism is, I don't know if you can hear me well.
Yes.
Okay, could you? Yeah, yeah. So I would like to say that autism does not define the ipsity of the subject. They lost their abilities to say I, and because of this, politics takes another test. And this test is that because they are the environment themselves, they cannot. They cannot feel that the other is not themselves. So in that way, when the music is produced, for example, or when someone else is moving, they are feeling that they are moving too as well. And politics is about how we direct the city, how we manage people, how we can control things in order to live together. But if you are yourself the others, and you don't feel the boundary between you and the others, well, the politics is very quickly down because you're managing yourself. And the main problem with autism is that they feel like lost of control of the others, and they don't understand where they are situated themselves toward the others. Politics is really upside down in that case, and it's not the managing one unit to another, it's more managing your feelings toward how we can grab things that we lose control of. And I'm very impressed of how she described Irene in the book, the way that people look around the environment, because it's so close to the truth, you know, and it's very difficult to put in pictures and to make it understandable for people who are not feeling that way. That recalled me one of the study I made when I was in France with the little babies, were having the syndrome of West, which is a form of autism, but that is detected very soon because it's a defect of the neural tube. And we had to do like some measurement of their sound. And one thing that we get is that they having sound they were not supposed to have. Meaning that they're producing, you know, like babies crying or just laughing, and they're producing sound. I mean, all of them, not only the West baby, that were not supposed to be in the range that we are supposed to measure. So we changed microphone for like acoustic microphone made for building, and then we detected that they had high level frequencies. Almost at the limit that when we cannot hear them anymore. And then we say to the lab director, well, how come us, even as an opera singer, I mean, you know, we can reach high notes, but not these notes. And how come these babies that's supposed to be having some kind of disabilities, even physiologically, because they were not have the ability to reach all these notes, and why 6 months later they cannot anymore? And it's the same thing what you say, like how can we lose that? What happened? Why they lose these abilities? What is the trick that makes things disappear that way? And I would say, like, you know, life is movement. You don't have nothing if you don't have movement. Movement is everywhere. In reading, in everything is movement. I would like to say that as children, we have abilities to make the movement ours. When we grow up, it's just like we feel like the boundary of your body becomes still. And well, it's an illusion, of course, but this distinction does not help us because you have a vicariance effect. When you look at others and you feel you are yourself, even if you don't move so much, you can still move because you feel other movement. But if you make the distinction so much that you feel like you are not part of it anymore, then you cannot have this ability to be part of. And I don't think that is only for autistic children.
Yes,
I think that all the children have this ability. And it's just because I guess autistic children have these issues with ipsity, that means that they cannot define themselves as one. They are the environment somehow. Mm-hmm. So it's a reason why they cannot go somewhere where there is too much anxiety. They will hurt themselves because they don't see the boundary, so they will feel like they will grab what is in the room as an atmosphere and take it personally, so to speak. And so this refusal of identity, so to speak, allows them to have this different way of thinking of the time. Issues is that all children, when they grow up, they are taught to be one and to be one shape and not something else, and you and the others are different. So it's really, I think that this text is not only for thinking about disability, it's also thinking of how we can escape from this, I don't know, like this way of thinking that is too this way of thinking that is putting us in boxes and doesn't allow us to see each other in another way.
Thank you, Justine.
I had a kind of a theory while I was listening to this about your question, or about when do we lose this ability to see the field rather than the objects, right? And I think I have two answers, they're not answers, they're towards answers, right?
Okay.
They're
beginning
answers. So one is, I think, well, maybe I should put it the other way around. I think when we learn to read, I think because reading involves chunking. So the habits of chunking that go with reading then get applied to everything else. And so I think, because I remember, I'm sure you've all done this, where you look at a page and now you cannot see it the way you saw it as a child before you learned to read. Yeah. When you saw it as a child, it was a bunch of symbols and you had no idea what was going on there. And then after you could read it, you can no longer see it as a bunch of symbols that you don't understand. You automatically parse it into a text. Obviously, if you read another language, then you're back to that field again. But so I do think that the parsing that we do when we learn to read is part of the problem. But the other thing, the thing that I had when you were first talking about it, the thing that came to mind is drawing. Because as a child, when you're first drawing, you're drawing the field, you know, and that's in to some extent, the reason children's drawings look so different to us and so naive in the sort of neurotypical language is because they're not drawing objects, they're drawing fields. And I think by the, you know, the reinforcement that we get, oh, that's, you could modify that and it would make it more, you know, you get that kind of feedback that starts to creep into the learning. Mm-hmm. And then you shift people away from seeing the drawing as an engagement with the environment. Anyway, it's just a thought there. I think the drawing may have something to do with it. I also wanted to just point out quickly, but I'm sure Heather can talk about it more, but the whole, I mean, this chapter and the next one, which Johnny is going to leave us through in a moment, they both concern this idea of the field rather than the objects. And Heather and I have been working on some ideas around poetic fields that relate to this. And they're strong, I think, are strongly informed by what's going on in these two chapters. They were the most interesting chapter. Chapter six is my favorite chapter after having read.
I was briefly going to build off what you said, Jeffrey, and just say that also too, reading and drawing is what takes us back into the field. Or arts in general, maybe, possibly just for me, maybe. But I'm seeing, there's the drawing of the field of the child, then there's the learning processes that we go through in early childhood, late childhood, and even becoming an adult to maybe learn different techniques. There's books on poetry that will teach you how to write poetry, possibly, or how to read poetry. But then that gives us, at least as neurotypicals, the understanding. We can read a 1,000-page book and completely understand what's going on, but to live in the world that this author is writing from or about is to step outside the book. I can read 30 pages of Erin Manning and possibly not understand a word she says until maybe the end or until this conversation here. And then I'll live what is being said. And that goes along with the chapter six as well, kind of the facilitation and also the autistic perception. Like, we don't want them to come into the neurotypical world. We've seen that's not, as Erin Manning's talking about, it's not holding on to their feeling. It's not holding on to their world. It's just dragging them into the objective world and taking the subjective out of it and becoming subject, maybe. I don't know. But there's kind of a balance of the two, or kind of a pulling in and a meeting. And then that's the field there for me. So yeah. That's all I want to say.
I'll just jump in really quickly with my experience since Jeffrey mentioned the field idea. So this book is hard for me to abstract myself out from. So I feel like I get really identified with the field that Erin is building. It's more of an experiential lexicon, I feel like. And so it's hard for me to kick back into logical brain in order to cognize the experience and explain it. So I'm finding that I have to do recursive reading, a little bit of, you know, going back. I read this very carefully the first time, but now I'm having to go back in and get that more logical surface level sense of what happened because I find it very hard to remember. And I enjoy the experience completely, and I enjoy what it's refiguring. And just to speak to Cora's question about politics or what she brought up, this is mediating something I can't quite put into words for me. It's very important, though, being someone who has to deal with identity politics all of the time, and what she's pulling out of Guattari's experience with schizophrenics as and the way it refigures subjectivity to sidestep the neurotypical. And I think part of my difficulty in putting it into words is I have a lot of experience that mimics sort of the autistic, but I don't have, I haven't put things together yet, like how psychosis is deterritorialized from the subject, and then how she refigures that into an ecology of experience and what that might mean applied to some of my own frustrations with work in the academy and how to speak about difference. Because what she's doing is really radical here. It's like she's taking the Undercommons, which I haven't read yet and I need to, it's been in my world for a while, but taking the Undercommons, and rather than critiquing it, she's actually diving in and continuing to I don't know. I don't know enough about the inner commons, but I think there's something really there in that nexus politically that's significant and that could help me make some of my own points better. So there was something else I wanted to mention very quickly. Forms of subjectivity.
Take your time.
Ecology of the world. Okay. I just want to share a little bit about my personal experience growing up. So when I was in eighth grade, I was at a summer camp and we were watching a murder mystery. And this was my first experience, I think, of watching the field and being aware that I thought differently, because this was a camp for gifted students. And yet we're watching this murder mystery and every team was supposed to come up with a theory about who did it. And I knew who did it, but I could not have told you why, because I was attuning to some gesture in the field that cued me in to why it was happening. But then when we had to rationalize, my team won because I gave them the answer, but when we had to rationalize why, I couldn't. So similar to this experience right now, in a way, of not being able to put into words the experience of kind of that loss of subjective identification or logical organization of an identity that knows and rationalizes, instead of one that intuits and empathizes and feels. So love this chapter. Really hard to presence that into words, what it is I love about it. So sorry for stumbling around a bit there.
Thank you. You could take all the time you wanted and I'd be happy. So even if it's just, gee, I don't know about this, or I don't know. you have a talent for articulating field elements that we all feel, but you say that you don't get it, but in a way, you get it faster than I do. You get there faster about things that are difficult for me to even recognize that. And then when you say them, I go, oh yeah, she's right. That's fair.
Thank you for that feedback. I think it's about attending to the implicit, which is a Jinlin term. You know, what's implicit in the reading experience. And it's more of a feeling. Mm-hmm. I think he goes really well with Manning. But yeah, thank you for that feedback.
I wanted to do a brief exercise for the group to lead off the next chapter, Carrying the Feeling. But I wanted to respond to the mix of voices here and all of the insights that are being brought up and the things that are being triggered as I listen, because I remember very early experiences. When did we, all children are geniuses, and when did that stop? And how do we recapture that? And is there a risk in recapturing that genius?
Absolutely.
These are the big questions that I have. And I remember, as you were talking about drawing, Jeffrey, and about the field, and how children are just naturally attuned to it. I remember a specific moment. I think I was maybe 4 or 5. My little brothers, two of my brothers, they're twin brothers. They're 2 years younger than I am. And they were there at the table with me and we were all coloring. And I remember I held the color like this, you know, and not like a pencil, but like with my fist. And I remember the sensation of just moving across the page with all these various colors. And it was a coloring book. There was an outline, a shape that was pre-given. And my uncle, I remember him telling me, you need to draw inside the lines. And I just didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, the lines, look, the lines, you have to stay inside the line. And I was like, but why would anyone want to do that? I just thought that was the oddest thing in the world. But I obviously learned how to do that in order to fulfill requirements and the criteria of those who are around me, who are in charge, who were directing my attention to what they considered important. But I also reserved something that was very private and hidden and surreptitious, I maybe, or even transgressive. As I got older, it became quite transgressive. That basically I dedicated myself to, I know what the lines are and I know what the rules are, and I'm going to break every one of them that I can get away with. I'm not necessarily interested in getting punished, but I am interested in exploring why those in charge are so paranoid about maintaining these sort of rigid boundaries. And I found out very often there are good reasons. And you need to, and I think an ecology of participating observers, as I think Jocelyn was mentioning, urban planners are trying to create a city where we can all live together. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I think as we start to shift our attention from the brain, you know, to brains in plural, because there never is a brain without a body, without an environment. And I think this very naive notion that we're brain, that there's a brain in a vat that can have generate some sort of field effect is extremely dubious. And I think as we start to go into that undermind that I think, or that the undercommons that I think you were referencing with, and that our author references, Edgar Morton, I can't remember his name. But anyway, I think something similar to that is like the invisible architecture that we carry around with us, like stay in the lines and preserve that pre-given form that other people are going to reward you if you do and penalize you if you don't, or something in between. You may always find allies who are as interested as you are in those transgressive moves. So I think that, I do find it really fascinating that if we start to, and I think the exercise that I want to present to the group, about 15 minutes, to sort of explore some of that, how we habitually chunk in sort of pre-given ways. And that, except when accidents happen or surprises or things that we don't know what to do. You know, I've never been in this situation before. I don't know how to chunk it. So I think it's not about stop chunking. That would make our lives impossible, especially a social life. I think it's what Manning is saying here is we need to, I think I quoted her somewhere. How does adjacent work in the event of communication? She says neurotypicals interested in art making or exploring movement must learn to develop techniques to chunk less quickly. I think that's something, or chunk slower. I think that really helps. Not just if you're working with people who are artistic or who have dementia or who have a disability. It's very important if you do have relationships with persons, like I have a very close friend with Parkinson's. I learned how to walk slowly at his pace. And sometimes he can walk faster, sometimes he can't, he has to slow down, sometimes he has to stop because his meds haven't kicked in yet. And he is almost comatose. But I've learned, you know, how to adapt to his rhythm. And I've also felt that sense of urgency, like, let's pick up the pace, we've got to keep going. You know, we got to make it to the bus stop on, you know, so we can get to the movie on time. All those kinds of, I'm chunking things in a certain way with a certain kind of style and with a certain kind of tempo rhythm that won't work in a relationship with this particular person whom I dearly love. And I've learned how to adapt. And this has happened, I think I'm sure many of us have had these experiences of, you know, friends or family members who have had a stroke or had an illness or broke a leg and had to, required some assistance. Or, you know, you just have to find a way, or certainly children, if you have to take care of children or the elderly. I think we have to learn how to chunk slowly or chunk at an appropriate pace so that we can coordinate our social lives. this is an ongoing experiment since I live in a very big, busy city where people are very paying more attention to their devices than they are to the adjacent, what's adjacent to them. Well, actually, in a way, I guess their device is the most thing that's most adjacent to them. But I think it's it creates a kind of tunnel vision in a way. Anyway, those are some of my responses to what has been already articulated so well here. And also, I saw Quantum Poetics, and I looked at the video that you guys did the other day, and I really enjoyed it because I do think there's great overlaps in our interests here and how we might create field effects that are more ecological. Because we are, I mean, we are living in multiple fields. I think it's very rare, though, that I think people are actually paying attention to how they're creating a field, that the field that they are participating in shapes their experience, and that they shape that field through their participation. And being able to play at those boundaries and be aware of the invisible architecture of each person. If I can become aware of the invisible architecture, the undermined, which is not easy, but if I can start to do that, and if you can do that, and if we can do that, and I know a little bit about your invisible architecture, and you know a little bit about mine, I believe we could create all kinds of shifts that would be very beneficial. Because then I think we would be breaking out of that grid where I have a separate brain inside a separate body, and so do you, and we have to use language in these really crude kind of correspondences. Sending information through this tube to another person, they decode the information in their way, and that we create these clunky kind of information systems, which I think is not true at all. I think our intersubjective spaces are profoundly psychic and telepathic, and we don't know what other people mean by the words they say, and it doesn't matter. You know, we're paying attention to the 99% of their communication, which is nonverbal, which is infinitely more important than any content that's going to come up with. So anyway, thanks for this chance to improvise with everyone else's improvisation. And I'm interested in what happens next.
I just want a quick point, Johnny. I don't disagree with the desire to spill over the lines. Obviously, I'm a lot like that too. But I'm aware that, so Jocelyn has her oldest son, Elias. He loves to draw and color very precisely. And so there's his field is this intricate, precise coloring, and he gets his enjoyment from that, I think, more than the sort of broad strokes in the canvas. So I think it can be very different for different people. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that it's not that it's always the right thing to do to spill over the line. Sometimes the need is different. Right? Yeah.
Before you move on to, sorry.
Go ahead, Marco.
Well, John was going to move into the next chapter with an exercise, but I wanted to bring up a reservation that I experienced while reading this chapter, chapter 5. Maybe it was something that I sensed before, and you've frozen. I wonder if I've frozen. Can you still hear me? Yeah? Okay.
Yep.
I think it's something I sensed before, but I articulated to myself as I was reading this, or it became kind of more apparent to me. And that's this binary, I think, that Aaron sets up between the neurodiverse and the neurotypical. And I got the feeling, you know, through the repetition of that argument, and through her, I think, you know, valorous attempts to highlight and to bring attention to and to value the neurodiverse. But I got the feeling that she was sometimes setting up the neurotypical as a kind of bad guy, or the you know, the thing that we all assume that that is, it's almost like the you know, the sin or something in this narrative. And I got to thinking, well, you know, that's almost the same way that you know, in identity politics, you have to set up these binaries or these kinds of antinomies between identities, one of which is privileged and the other of which is maybe underprivileged, and then what you do is you privilege the underprivileged, and that creates a whole new, you know, sort of caste system or privilege system. I wonder if that's happening, because you know, if we just think about it from a natural, you know, perspective, right? An ecological perspective. For the most part, we need typicalities. We need regularities. Like if I'm reaching for a piece of food and I'm not able to coordinate, and I just say I here out of convention, but if I'm not able to coordinate reaching that apple or that food and bringing it to my mouth, if things are always shifting and half the time when I reach for the apple, I end up, you know, knocking over something else, and there isn't coherence in the field, then I don't think life continues. Like, I think that we need neurotypicality, and we need to have those lines. And of course, it's problematic when they become reified. And it's also problematic when, you know, those who cannot or choose not to draw within those lines, to perform the neurotypical kind of choreography, when they're not included. I mean, that's, I think, what Manning is addressing. But I would be wary, I think, of sort of playing that card too often or too strongly. Because, I mean, like you say, like if you really take neurodiversity to its extreme, I mean, neuro is already talking the language of brains. And like everybody, human body anyway, has a brain. So by definition, it's total neurodiversity, but there's also going to be commonalities between those brains, and there are going to be some outliers as well. And some of those outliers are going to have you know, profound gifts, profound abilities, and capacities, and others are not going to have those, but they're going to have other kinds of experiences. And I see Aaron attempting to valorize those experiences, and also to show that there's something that you lose by being fully identified with a neurotypical mode of being. But sometimes I wonder if, you know, like it's like if she, if there's the question of what the person wants. Like this chapter five begins, it's really the first half of it is the critique of this fellow Ido Kedar. And I wondered, Jeffrey, by the way, just whether your novels have any connection to this fellow. But here's a person whose, I think, basic story, not, you know, at least as represented here, is who's autistic, and who's gone from a condition of not being able to communicate, then being, you know, through various therapies, gaining an ability to communicate in these neurotypically desired ways, and maybe in that process losing what might have been special, what might have been unique in his primary or his prior mode of experiencing and communicating. But he wanted that, and I, you know, I think that the argument gets a little bit too close to maybe saying that he shouldn't have wanted that. He should have wanted to, like, you know, find other ways that are non-neurotypical to communicate. And I think that that might be, that might have, you know, there are interesting potentials there. I mean, that's, I think, the real gift of this writing, is that it opens up the sort of exploration of what are ways that communication can happen through facilitation, through other means, that don't kind of channel it into these, you know, approved modes. But like John said earlier, a lot of times the you know, those modes, those rules, those lines are there for a reason, and that they're not arbitrary is, I think, part of what I think I'm working with a little bit. Like, there's a reason for them being there, and unless we can tell that story and account for why neurotypicality is the way it is, which, you know, has many, many reasons, then it just risks becoming a little bit too flat of a argument and sort of a straw man. Like every, you know, the neurotypicality is always going to get it kind of miss the deeper experience that's possible. So that's all I wanted to present, that just that reservation that I feel, because I think she has a wonderful thing to say, but I'm wary of excluding like comments, like a certain amount of common sense, like that, you know, it would be better to be able to reach the thing that you want to reach, or it would be better to be able to communicate in the way that you want to. That's all.
I'll just respond quickly, just a short thought here is, this is coming from the area of dance again, but there's a famous modern dance pioneer, Martha Graham, and she would say that there's no freedom in freedom, there's freedom in structure. And she created this beautiful architecture of movement in which the boundaries of that, so we can call those the lines perhaps, the boundaries in which to adhere to were difficult. It's a tough architecture, but within that architecture, if you're willing to adhere to that, you are able to find, almost press against those lines and structure and try to find freedom within that from a physical, literally from a physical experience. So I hear what you're saying, and it sort of gets into the notion of constraint as well too, but I won't go there right now. But I was just looking, something reminded me in that chapter where Erin says, page 120, she says, is it possible to create an account of imminent movement and autistic perception that convinces us that there are other ways to be free? And I find that quite interesting as well too, that we are sort of moving, is there a way to move within some of these, and we can call them neurotypical structures, boundaries, lines, whatever those things are, is that the act? Is that the process? Is this the imminent process of finding something new, new ways to be free amidst that? So you just reminded me of a pretty close physical experience of those lines and boundaries that do serve a purpose in a particular way.
I just want to, I'm just going to do a point of order here. I do feel that the chapter 6, which was 40 pages long and has quite a lot in it, what I'd kind of like to do is have the discussion of chapter 6 spill over into next week so that we can start it today, but we won't finish it today. And it will have to add another session on the end, but one of the things I noticed when I was looking at the book carefully was that there's an extended appendix that I hadn't included in, that looks that it's substantive. It's not just an add-on, it's got elements in it. So I'm gonna sort of reconfigure the last the last session and add another one on. If you're okay with that, where we'll look at the rest of chapter 6 and chapter 7 next week, and we'll do chapter 8 and the appendix on the last session. So it's a slight reconfiguration. So just so you don't feel like we need to rush into chapter six at this point. We still have a few things coming up around chapter five. Definitely agree with you, Marco, about the, you know, the, but I do about the relative balance between neurotypical and neurodiversity. But I do, I mean, one of the things Erin said when she was with us that first time was that she herself just shifted on this issue, that when she wrote that chapter, she was more focused on the issues of neurodiversity, and that since then she's sort of broadened her understanding, and that we all are variations of neurodiverse from typicality to, and we need to be more aware of the spectrum rather than the extremes per se. That's what I understood from what she was saying. She also has gone out of her way to point out that the whole idea of the minor gesture is not a negation of the major gesture. So that is also, I think, a part of the discussion, that we're focusing on the minor gesture, but we're not saying the major gesture is bad. The world is mostly, is still a lot major, and the major is not inconsequential, right?
Sure. Yeah, that would relate to the political question as well, as far as, you know, what we engage with or what we interact with as quote unquote political. There are still elections that happen that are major events, right? There are still all kinds of even identity-based movements that need to be constituted as they are to perhaps achieve certain objectives that would not be possible if, you know, there weren't that chunking that occurs. But if that's all that politics is, if it's just those major kinds of, you know, movements, and there isn't attention to the much less well-defined, the more incipient, the more subtle, the more underground, like, I think that's really what the strength of this argument is that it's kind of it's deconstructing that presumption about what it means to act politically, what it means to constitute or to be part of or a political movement. And it's also bringing attention to not just identity, but experience, like a diversity of ways of experiencing what is political and what affects what the body politic is. So that was very thought-provoking, I'll say. Like, despite whatever my reservations, and I think that it sounds like, you know, that Aaron's thought has moved beyond this text. And I could see how that would happen, for sure.
Johnny, Justin has been trying to say something. Could we do Justin and then come back to you, and then you can move on to the next?
Yeah, I would like to do this exercise. I think it'd be about half an hour, but I want to leave discussion too.
Yeah.
Trying to pace. But it's good that maybe the conversation can go to the next session also.
Yeah. Justin, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I would like to, to add something to what was just said. I mean, to talk on a personal level, I don't think I'm neurotypical. By reading this book, I definitely think I'm not. But what I learned also is that if I'm not normal, so to speak, I don't think that anyone is normal as well from every point of view that normality should be on this point of view of observing the environment. I think that the way we perceive the environment is deeply rooted to our belief. Or we believe we have a body, we believe we have one personality, we are taught that we speak, and when we speak, we are I. And so all of this is educational, is our way to be educated. And in that way, the politics play a part, because of course, by
by being this way, we are well situated all together. But in fact, if we doubt, as other philosopher did when they tried to understand what is a water, what is a fire, like Heracles trying to understand what is a fire, what is a water, what is the elements, so to speak, and we all have no answer. What are we? Why should I feel pain and why the other does not feel pain? And why the other feels the pain I feel? You know, there is all these questions that are still open. And the role typicality or disability never gives any answer to all these questions. And what I like with Erin's books is to show that, of course, it is a disability. And we should never think this pain that produces disability in another way of thinking. But we have to consider that maybe our way of thinking is a bit too aside of what is a real question of our perception of the world. I remember when I did my thesis that there were a gathering of all kind of thinker from all over the world. And the question they asked was, why the brain is not in the feet? You know, it was a question like this that brings new technology. And I'm not saying that there is a right way and a wrong way of thinking. But I think that the way we educate our children, the way we think about the world itself, has to be put in different shade, different lights, and taking everything for granted as we saw it, we may be surprised that things are not looking as they should. I mean, we are not reaching with our eyes the true nature of the things.
Great. I think maybe that's a good lead-in to chapter 6, John, if you...
Okay, Marco, can I ask you a question? Do you have access to a paper, something to...
Yeah. Write? Yep.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. This is very interactive, what I plan to do. I'm just going to take you through this process. So get comfortable, everybody. Just relax. I'm going to ask you some questions. And I'm just going to invite you to muse upon those questions. And whatever comes up, I want to explore the pronoun I, the personal pronoun I. And I'm going to explore all of the pronouns. Very briefly, ask a few questions and have you map something to represent that. And then we can reflect on this whole process. And I hope we'll learn a little bit more about how we chunk. And also, I'm curious on how we might facilitate socially. So I learn how you learn how I learn. So we can facilitate one another in that process. So are we ready?
Yep.
Okay. And I, and when I, where is I? And what kind of I is that I? And is there anything else about I? And does I have a size or a shape? And when I, how old could I be?
And what would I like to have happen? So please take a piece of paper and represent I in a way that makes sense to you, and note what I would like to have happen. So please take another moment or another minute to wrap this up, and I'll proceed to ask you another batch of questions. Okay, we about ready, everybody? Okay, thank you. Okay. I'm gonna do the basic same round of questions, but with a different pronoun. And me, and when me, where is me? Whereabouts is me? And what kind of me is that me? And is there anything else about me? And does me have a size or a shape? And when me, how old could me be? And what would me like to have happen? So please take a piece of paper and represent me in a way that makes sense to you. Take a few moments to map that out.
take another moment to complete that as much as you can. And you, and when you, whereabouts is you? And what kind of you is that you? And is there anything else about you? And does you have a size or a shape? And when you, how old could you be? And what would you like to have happen? So just take a moment to map that out, represent that in a way that makes sense to you. Just take another minute. Thank you. And myself. And when? Myself. Where is myself? What kind of myself is that? Is there anything else about myself? And does myself have a size or a shape? And when myself, how old could myself be? And when myself, what would myself like to have happen? Map that out in any way that makes sense to you. Now I'm going to use each of your name. And I'm just going to go around the circle here and ask another clean question using your name. You don't, of course, have to answer verbally. And when Coralie, where is Coralie? And when Marco, what kind of Marco is that? And when Heather, does Heather have a size or a shape? And Jocelyn, what kind of Jocelyn is that? And Doug, and when Doug, how old could Doug be? And Jeffrey, whereabouts is Jeffrey? And when I, and me, and you, and myself, what would I, me, you, myself, like to have happen? With all of that, what do you know now that you didn't know before about your outcome? So take all the time you need to finish up a map or a drawing or a sketch or notes to yourself. When you're ready, please reorient to this space as we can stay connected to the field and appreciate our co-facilitation. And we can return to a more conversational mode that's agreeable to everybody. And I'm curious, I don't know about you guys, if there's a relationship between anything that came up for you in this exercise and carrying the feeling across in this chapter. So I just want to create an open frame so that we can all explore this together. Thank you.
I'll just quickly say that my conclusion that made, or what I gained is, or just some words, which when reading about language, body, and the senses, I have trouble parsing it all together. But through this exercise, I've come to realize, oh, language, body, senses, that it's all present for me.
And language, body, senses are all present for you. Thank you. Who has something different?
chair. With that final question, I now feel like a cord. So I had a sense of being pulled apart with each one of these rounds into a different gesture or experience of myself. And with the you and the myself, I had the hardest time because you, I felt this both and quality of being addressed and referenced in a more objective sense. And with myself, I had the sense of that Escher hands drawing, reflexive or meta, looking back at myself and creating it. So those were the hardest, I think. Me was very sweet and interior and personal.
And I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. And me was sweet and personal.
And interior. Yeah, I could actually feel it in my central channel when you pointed to me as a place that I speak from, or more like heart center. I could feel me very comfortable with me. I'm very comfortable with me.
Very comfortable with you. With me, excuse me.
Yeah.
You, hardest time, referenced, objective. Just trying to use your exact words.
Both addressed and referenced in an objective sense. So I didn't know if the you was addressing me. So that stopped my mind when I couldn't land with you question. So it was, you're speaking to us in the sense of you, but then also when we, yeah, I don't know. I felt like there was a referencing.
And a cord and being pulled apart.
That was at the end when you said, what do you know now that you didn't know before? And I brought all of these pronouns together.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
So like Heather, my me was very interior. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys can see that.
Yes, I see it.
So it's beautiful. A kind of yoke with impingements from outside, and then the outside world is these sort of squiggly bits around the edge. That's me. I was very different.
Yes, I see it.
So not quite sure exactly what to say about that. It's something about the things at the bottom are being grounded and being mobile at the same time. The ones on the front, sort of front, what I think of the front, is not an eye, but it's maybe a visceral entry point for the world towards, but the eye I saw as the sort of active part of the self. And the me is the interior part. And then you, you can see that.
Yes, I see it.
It's a kind of a field of different waves going in different directions. So you is a kind of field of perceptions. And myself, I had a lot of trouble with. And I ended up doing a child's kind of perspective of the body.
Can you raise it up just a little bit? That's it. Okay, great. Thank you.
So the body and the sun, uh-huh, and the ground. And I broke the body up because I wasn't quite happy with this stick figure body. So, and then the Jeffrey was a map with all the different pieces in relation to each other, except the final piece, which I didn't quite know how to fit within. So the I and the me is inside the I, and the you is in front as part of the environment. Anyway, so it's kind of a map like that. So
thank you.
I thought it was a very interesting way of rethinking the different pieces that I don't, we tend to think of them as all being the same thing, and to view them as somewhat differently, or to delve into why, how we feel about those different pieces is interesting. So.
Thank you very much. And also, if anyone has anything they want to visually show to the group, that would be great. And I would love it if you would feel comfortable posting this on our forum. It would be great. These images, yeah. Jeff, they would be there for us. Thank you. Jocelyn, would you like to go next?
First of all, I'm sorry because I have to leave in a couple of minutes, so thank you so much for asking me now. Well, I had an issue with this exercise because me, I have issues with boundaries. Me, myself, I, you, and what was the other, myself, is a bit the same. And my drawing for all of this is, I don't know if you can see it clearly, but basically
move it back a little bit. Yeah, I can see it better there.
Yeah, well, it's a collection of some points that can look like a little man, and they all link together as a fractal perspective, and we are all the points somehow. And we are not, we're all different shape in different time, but we are all the same, living in the different constraints, physical constraints. And the perception is different from where you are in the drawing. So self and I can change, you know, different perspective. It depends where you look at somehow. But you cannot really say, even if, especially when you are incarnated in one of them, you cannot really say who you are really, because you cannot see what the other, but you can look at the other and judge them as it was not you, because you don't think it's you, but it's you. Sorry, I'm always allowed to get out on Wednesdays.
Thank you very much. And. Please feel free to post anything.
Oh my God.
any pictures, any commentary?
Yeah. I'm not sure I can.
No, it's just an invitation, not a requirement.
Okay. Thank you. And Coralie, I have to go. I'm very sorry about that.
Thank you, Jocelyn.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
See you next time. So we have two more to go, Coralie and Marco, correct? Yes. Okay. Coralie, would you like to go now?
Sure. Sort of looking back at this and looking at the page as a whole, there's a lot of direction, the notion of gaze, and funny enough, something about sound with those words. So with eye, the notion of being very purposeful of my gaze and direction being outward away from myself. And that's a louder representation of, I can't use any of the pronouns because it won't make sense now. That's a louder representation of me. Me, there is no outward direction. The gaze is within me, and I relate to Heather as well too, that this is a very quiet place. And reflected. You, interestingly, all the lines of direction are coming towards me. It has a performative feel to it. It's louder. The you is louder because I hear other voices around me. Myself, similar to me, is probably the quietest place where I feel most alone, most intimate, most authentic, where again, any sort of direction or gaze remains more internal.
Thank you. See, I wish we had more time because we could unpack this, each of your contributions. We could go on for hours.
Think about it and come back maybe next time.
Please. Yeah. That's a great idea. If anything else comes up and you want to explore it, we can do that at the next talk. Marco, would you like to go now?
I'm going to try to show you what I did. Let's see. I always enjoy these exercises. Can you see that?
Yes, yes.
Perfect. There might be some shadows on it, but when you started with I just wrote the letter I. And then as I was looking at the letter I realized that this was a construction. It was a mark on a page, and it represents the thing that we're talking about. But I just wondered, you know, what was the value of putting that right in the middle and circling it and not knowing what was to come in the rest of the exercise. So I thought, I don't know, let me do something with it. Let me play with it in some way. And I saw then like a tennis court, and the eye, the middle of it, the downward, the vertical line looked like it could be the net, and then the two horizontal lines looked like they could be the borders. And then so I drew somebody playing in tennis against a big monster that ended up looking like the rabbit from the movie Donnie Darko to me. And as we kind of moved through the other pronouns, I just started situating them on the page around the eye. And so the me got, you know, kind of brought in this cartographical kind of element, to like a trail. You have a trailhead, and or, you know, finding a location. It's like here. So I located the me as a here, as an X. And then the you, sort of as this center of energy that's there. So there's a here and then a there. And then the mice, and then somewhere in the middle, I got distracted and I started drawing a brain with a zipper down the front of it, because Jeffrey had talked about zippers being important in his fashion design. And so the zipper goes down the middle of the brain between the two hemispheres. I don't know if you can see that.
Yes,
and then with myself, I remember, like, I had been outside as we were speaking earlier, and I saw a blackbird, or a black colored bird, I don't know if it was actually a blackbird, eating a worm. And then I remembered my to-do list. And so I put the to-do list, a mock to-do list next to it. Anyway, I just kind of, you know, doodled and had fun with it. And then started filling it in as things occurred to me. Like there's a UFO swarm over here, and a crowd of observers. That was kind of the them that you didn't say. They're kind of watching my tennis match. And then I realize I'm the person playing against this monster across the net of my eye. So, yeah. Anyway, it was fun.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
I also had a thing about the ages. So I have the me is the oldest. You is the second oldest. I is the third oldest. Myself is the fourth oldest. And Jeffrey is the fifth oldest. So I had this sequence of age.
Wow.
You know, just a thought on this. Gao Zhijing, in his novel Soul Mountain, which we were reading, he plays with these pronouns. The whole novel is written through the perspective of either an I or you or a she or he. And he, in one of the chapters, talks about how each generates the other, how the you generates the I, and out of the interplay, a she is generated. So perhaps there's something to that genesis of the perspectives that, you know, makes one older than the other, gives them a kind of temporal unfolding.
Yes. Just briefly, I know we have about 5 more minutes, is that correct?
Yeah. Right on the dot, or?
And then we could go to next time. We could continue working on this chapter. Having had this shared experience today, we'll probably reflect on that between now and then. And I would be, I'm very interested in what she quotes William James a lot, and the whole notion of volition and agency and what that could mean. And I was very drawn to, we were previously talking about agency and adjacement, and synonyms for adjacement would be accommodation, adjustment, arrangement, composition, conjecture, carries with it a sense of mobilizing, of movement towards an undeniable effect on the conditions of experience unfolding. So very briefly, I want to tell you about something that happened to me when I was in my 20s. It was a visionary episode. It's a very disastrous time in my life. And I had a lucid dream. And in the lucid dream, I was seeing people in slavery, enslaved people with chains being whipped and being dragged through a street. And I said out loud, "Do you want to live like a slave?" And I started to run. And there was a meadow, a beautiful meadow with a light, like a spotlight. And I knew that if I got to the center of that spotlight, that light, on top of that hill and that meadow, that I would vaporize. I would die, I would be beamed up, whatever. I didn't care. I just didn't want to live in this world of slaves. So I was running towards it, expecting total annihilation. And as I got into the center of that spotlight, all around me were arrows and javelins, and they were piercing my body. Just like St. Sebastian, you know, everything is like a pincushion. And I looked down and I saw my dream body was just full of these arrows and javelins, but I wasn't dead. And I said, "But I'm still alive." And then I heard a voice from above, a male voice. And it was very calm. And it said, or he said, "Now go back and make a living arrangement." And I woke up having no idea what a living arrangement could possibly be. So I'm getting this feeling as I reread this chapter, as I read this chapter today and studied it and listened to all of your multiple, your different voices and your different ways of making sense, that there's differences, but there's no difference so far presented that I can't sort of figure out. And I think that I'm starting to reflect on that voice. Who does that voice belong to? And I sort of assumed it was God's voice, but now I'm not so certain. So I think there's a relationship, more of a partnership than a top-down kind of dynamic, where some wise self gives commands. And this wasn't a command. It was much more about making a living arrangement, which is something that only I would be able to figure out. So I'm sort of moving from God as top-down kind of model to God as much more like a sibling or an equal or a partner. And I just wanted to share that because I'm sure many of us have had enormous perplexity around these pronouns and the subject-object split that we've all been trained in our factory model educations. As we start to get older, we feel impatient with that. Many of us do. And I think this kind of exercise and this kind of book that we're studying, we can, I think, reconnect to those fields and reactivate that genius. And I do believe we can make it safe enough for that genius. If we can create those conditions, it would be great. So thank you all for this opportunity. A lot of fun.
Thank you. That was beautiful, Johnny, and certainly something to take away. I don't know if people have to leave.
I'd like to maybe discuss just a little bit about the actual dates.
You have things to do, or
the actual
dates? So the last two, I guess, are going to fall. If we continue chapter 6 and 7, it'll fall on July 4th, which is 2 weeks from now. And then that'll put us at July 18th for the final chapter 8 and postscript. I was wondering if we could maybe shift it to next week, which would be June 27th. That way it's a little more fresh in our minds. And it would also avoid, at least here in the States, it would avoid the July 4th holiday that I know I wouldn't be able to make it. So it's more of a selfish proposal here, but.
That's a good idea. In fact, I was worried about the July 4th thing. So that's actually, I have to make sure that I let the others know.
Mm-hmm.
that we're meeting next week instead of 2 weeks from now. But if that works for people, it does for me.
Yeah, I wanted to check with everybody here. So that would be the June 27th and July 11th, if we did it that way.
Good with me.
That's fine.
I think so. I just have to do a double check, but I'll have a look.
Works for me.
Okay. And I'll make the changes on the site, and I guess, Jeffrey, you'll be able to contact Jocelyn and whoever else.
Yeah. Also, I'm looking for somebody to introduce chapter 7 for the next time. Mark, you haven't done it yet, but I don't want to put you on the spot.
So that would this be for next week or for the 2 weeks after that?
It would be for next week.
I'll do it.
All right.
In the act, the shape of precarity. Ooh. This would be a tightrope walk.
And I'll do the final ones on the next week because everybody's sort of been through the job, so...
All right.
6th and 7th for the 27th. Is that right?
Yes, 6th and 7th. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
And then the last chapter in the appendix for the 11th. You said, Doug. Yeah.
Is it an appendix or is it a postscript? I see a postscript too.
But it's quite long. That's what I noted. So,
yeah, it's postscript.
Okay, good. Okay. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, very good. Thank you. Bye.
So I guess we'll call it off there and keep the schedule. It's just that I so enjoy having everybody all the time. I just want it to keep going. But
thank you for facilitating, wow. Cora and John. That was great. And the practice was great.
Thank you. Yeah. My pleasure.
Mine as well.
Next time.
Take care. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.